Hello and welcome to Dialect from the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM, that's 103.2 FM up there in Preston, and Radio Verulam in St Albans. In the show this week, we had a feature from Eugene Byrne about how the lack of housing led to a surge of squatting after the Second World War. We visit Dorset, where you can see the Lurret on display. We have Tony Gosling with a feature about the history of aviation. And we have our very own Mike Noyce, usually a studio engineer here, but he'll be interviewing a Bristol band called Tom Holder and the Railway Sleepers. We have Malcolm Grieve with Chapter 12 from Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. We have a poetry by Rosemary Dunn here in the studio. And we also have Tim Burrows singing us one of his poems set to music. Finally, we also have Jess Sparks with his What's On Guide. I'm Michaela Dennis. Squatting has hit the news recently, and our first feature is by Eugene Byrne, which was recorded by Alec Milne at a recent Radical History Group walk in Bristol.
Post-war squatting movement. Most people think that squatting is a kind of an alternative political or philosophical idea. There was a time, and it's within living memory, when squatting was entirely respectable, mainstream, overwhelmingly working class, and with the overwhelming support of the rest of the UK population. Bristol was a major centre for this post-war squatting movement. The situation, as you can imagine, end of the Second World War, there is a desperate housing shortage. There are reasons for this. No new house has been built between 1939 and 1945 because the manpower and the materials have all been diverted to the war effort. And of course, the Germans have bombed lots of places. Lots of houses have been destroyed. Again, the manpower, the materials haven't been available to repair houses that have been damaged. And the war's end, something like 4.5 million men and women are being released from the armed forces and from other war industries, coming home again, quite often from abroad. So that by the summer of 1946, as more and more of these people were arriving back home, the housing shortage throughout the country, but in Bristol in particular, was absolutely desperate. Bristol, at the end of 1945, there's something like 26,000 people on the council house waiting list. Official figures state that something like 5,000 homes had been destroyed by German bombing, but I think when you take into account flats that were above commercial properties, the housing shortage was probably even more acute. At the same time, with all these millions of people coming out of the armed forces, but particularly the army, there are large numbers of military sites, particularly army camps, that are being vacated. And again, this is something that you'll have no real grasp of nowadays, but if you were around here in 1946, you would be fully aware that there's actually dozens of military sites throughout Bristol alone. And these range from actual army barracks, there are prisoner of war camps, there are military hospitals, there are supply depots, searchlight batteries, anti-aircraft gun batteries, lots and lots of these sites, most of which have living accommodation attached to them. So if you take, for example, you know, straightforward anti-aircraft battery, and there were about half a dozen of these around Bristol, I've no idea how many people would be living at them, but it'd be in the ballpark of about two dozen. So there's accommodation for two dozen people in one single little anti-aircraft battery. There's lots of room. Of course, people say, well, you know, there's a desperate housing shortage, why can't we live in these military sites? But the government, and indeed local government, is not in any hurry to release them. This is the post-war Labour government, Gould Lovett, and it wants to plan everything. It wants to run everything just so. And basically the reason they're not just going to let people go into these things is because it doesn't fit in with their sort of very orderly and rather bureaucratic vision of how they're going to solve the housing problem. As far as they're concerned, it's a matter of building as many council houses as possible, as quickly as possible, and in some cases also the famous post-war prefabs. Now, a lot of these are coming online in 1946, but it's still not nearly enough. So what happens, and this happens throughout the country, if you look to the history of your own community, you will find that the same thing happened there as well. The reason we're talking about Bristol is that it just happened to be particularly big in Bristol. The summer of 1946, there is a nationwide, very rapid, spontaneous movement over about 2 weeks in which people start simply walking in to these derelict army camps, taking them over and turning them into housing. There is some dispute as to sort of where this happened first. Some people say Stockton-on-Tees, but certainly the first place to attract mass attention was a camp at Chalfont St Giles in Buckinghamshire. And over the weekend of August 10th, 11th, about 100 families moved into that place, and it got a huge amount of 1946 media attention. That's to say, the newspapers, the radio, and of course later the newsreels. This is probably the single episode that triggers it. In Bristol, people are actually squatting what was called the White City Camp. It's down at Cumberland Basin at the entrance to the docks. The following Monday, the following Tuesday, seven other camps throughout the city have been occupied. By the end of the week, it's 20 camps. It's something like 900 people have taken over these camps. That's within the city of Bristol alone, within the space of a week. They have overwhelming popular support. And again, it's the same throughout the country. And they have that popular support for a number of reasons. The first is that they are using empty sites which are otherwise going to waste. This is government property. And people say, well, it's the government's responsibility to house us. We haven't got anywhere to live, so we're going to have this. Or conversely, they say, well, if it's government property, well, belongs to all of us. Let's have it. The second reason people support them is that every single one of these camps, the first thing they do, if they elect a management committee, they start a rent pool. So from the very minute that people move into these camps, people are paying a weekly rent, usually something like 7 shillings, 8 shillings a week. And of course, the third reason everyone supports them is that most of the people moving into these camps are families in which the male is almost always an ex-serviceman. 1946, these guys are heroes. A lot of them have medals. The other interesting thing about that is that the leadership is entirely working class. There's no posh people involved here. And what you find with a lot of the camps, certainly in Bristol and probably everywhere else as well, is that the leading management committee members are almost always former NCOs. During the war, they were corporals, they were sergeants, they were sergeant majors. These guys are used to organising, motivating other working men. That's how it worked. And so the government very quietly caved in. It had to be pragmatic about it. And by the autumn, it was handing over responsibility for these camps to the local authorities. And in Bristol, the city council set standard rents. It laid on water, electricity, sewerage services. Post was delivered to these places. And everyone lived happily ever after. As the years went by, most of these camps were vacated as people got council houses. Some of them were still occupied into the early 1950s. And of course, by then, it really wasn't very nice at all. When I wrote a small article about this for the local paper a couple of years ago, I had loads of lovely emails and letters back from people who'd actually lived in these places. And there was one very moving one from a woman who, as a girl, had lived in one of these places and who basically said that at school she was bullied because she lived in this grotty Nissen hut and not in a proper house. But in the end, it all ended up happily. Another woman wrote to me and said, 1949, we were allocated a house in Bristol, which of course we jumped at. Oh, the luxury of moving into a palace after 3 years in a Nissen hut.
Was Eugene Byrne there talking about squatting after the Second World War and recorded by Alec Milne. Our next feature was recorded on the beach at Burton Bradstock in Dorset, where they had an exhibition of two boats called the Lerret, which is unique to Chesil Beach. Our reporter Anthea Page finds out more, but first, some sunny music from Pink Floyd.
Distant bells, murmur and glass smell so
I'm standing on Burton Bradstock Beach in Dorset, and on the beach are two lerrets, and I'm here with one of the ladies, yeah, who built it.
That's hello. Right. Hello, hello. My name's Gail McGarver, and I'm a traditional wooden boat builder, and in front of us we have the mother boat, Vera, of 1923, and alongside her we have Little Sea, which is a new generation build lerret that I built last year. The lerrets go back to at least the 1600s, and they were built specifically to be launched off the steep stony shelves of Chesil Beach. They were used for mackerel fishing with a seine net, and the lerrets were in danger of extinction, and so this project was to preserve the lineage of the boat. But also, as I was building Little Sea, the new generation lerret, people came forward with their memories and photographs and articles of having worked the lerrets in bygone decades. And as a result of that, we've now launched an oral history exhibition telling the story of the lerret. So we're on tour on Burton Bradstock Beach, and we're working our way along the Dorset coast with the storytelling tent, which contains extracts from the oral history collection alongside Vera and Little Sea.
This boat is unique to this beach, is that right?
It's unique to Chesil Beach. The shape has evolved entirely to cope with the challenges of the steep stony shelves of Chesil Beach. For those of you who aren't familiar with the beach, it's quite a formidable terrain to launch a boat from, and these boats have been designed specifically to cope with these challenges. Very flat floored and very beamy, double ended, which allows them not to be swamped by the waves. And yeah, they're magnificent boats.
What's the biggest challenge then facing people going off this beach?
The launching. And
is it because the beach is steep?
The beach is very steep, and also you've got to get the timing of that launch absolutely spot on so you don't get swamped by the waves. The landing is equally as challenging. Yeah, it's a very steeply stony shelved beach and gets some fairly ferocious and formidable seas. So there's a lot of seaworthiness in the boats and a lot of seamanship skills in the people that used to fish from these boats.
Now, you were telling me earlier you actually built Little Sea, this boat here. Can you describe the wood that you've used?
Yeah, the wood is reflective of the mother boat. She's planked in elm, which sadly we struggle to source from this country. The elm's from, some of it's actually from Sweden and some of it's from Switzerland. So planked in elm, and she has a rib cage of oak Most of the skeletal structure of the boat is in oak, and most of that has been steamed into place. All of the materials chosen echo the build of the mother boat. She's riveted through with copper rivets that are hand beaten.
Beautiful boat. Do you get people wanting to paint her? Artists?
Yes, I have had some people come forward, actually. I'm awaiting the results.
Is this the newest, but sadly the last of the Lerwick boats?
The last new Lerwick before Little Sea was built reputedly over 40 years ago. And I said earlier they were in danger of extinction. We have Vera of 1923. There are a couple of others along these shores and a few others aside that are in rather more sorry states. So it could well be that without preserving the lineage through Little Sea, they may have been lost forever. Whether I get to build another, we shall see.
It didn't take you very long, did it?
No, it took me 7 months, and there's the research part of it as well. I work very much in close conjunction with the communities that boats belong to, in a sense. So I had some volunteers working on the project, some retired woodworkers, people from the local town coming to either, you know, help with the rivet or help with the oiling. And I worked very closely with the boat building academy in Lyme Regis, who very kindly housed the builder of the boat, so working with trainee boat builders. So it's been a wonderful collective endeavour. The oars were made by local people, tutored by Mike Broom from the Boat Building Academy with funding assistance from National Historic Ships. And the exhibition that's on tour has been kindly funded by the Heritage Lottery Fund.
How much public interest have you had in the exhibits?
A phenomenal interest. I've been here since early this morning, and we've had a whole mixture of people, some who've sought us out specifically because they knew it would be here today and they have either family links with Lerwick's, or they were very familiar with Lerwick's in decades gone by, and then people who've just come by chance, come to the cafe, then come on down onto the shore and have just been enchanted by the boats and the whole story behind them. It's part of an ongoing collection. So if anybody has any memories that they'd like to share about the Lerwick fishing, then if they would like to contact Lyme Regis Museum, then we can add their memories to the collection.
That was Anthea Page there, down on the beach at Burton Bradstock in Dorset. Ask anyone where the first aeroplanes were tested and developed, and most people will think about 1903 and Orville and Wilbur Wright's famous 12-second flight in Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. But whilst theirs was the world's first manned flight, much of the glider, aero, engine and propeller technology used by the Wright brothers was tested and developed in around Somerset, Bath and Bristol. Bristol's famous Filton Airfield is set to close soon to make way for housing, a sad symbol of Britain's industrial decline. So over the next few weeks, Dialect is looking back at Bristol and Somerset's role in aviation history. And this week we start with John Stringfellow, the flying man of Chard, who demonstrated the world's first powered flight to his colleagues of the Chard Institute in 1848, over 50 years before the Wright brothers.
I'm Roger Carter. I'm the collection curator of the museum. I look after all the objects and the archive in the museum.
Now, we all think of the United States as developing flight, but the initial work, it seems, was actually done in Somerset.
Yes, it took place really all around the world as well. There was a lot of work in France, but in Somerset, it developed really from someone's hobby. John Stringfellow, an engineer in the lace industry, the machine lace industry, in his spare time, he used to invent all sorts of things, batteries, engines for cars. He developed a balloon and early flight. John Stringfellow was the son of an engineer. He worked with a chap called Henson, who was actually a mill owner. John Stringfellow moved down to Chard because a lot of the industry was being moved away from Nottingham, where there were lace riots, and they set up lace mills in Chard. He made things called bobbins and carriages, which were the moving parts in a lace machine. The lace they were making was machine lace, and this was made in very large quantities for windows and mosquito nets. So this was just plain lace, plain net lace. Now, his hobby He first of all developed the idea with Henson of having a heavier-than-air machine, and Stringfellow's skill was in making engines, and he made these little steam engines which were far more powerful and very much lighter than anything that had existed before. And of course these engines mustn't have any vibration either. And so they made an aeroplane and they tried to fly it. They also took out a patent which had to go through Parliament. Everyone laughed at them because the idea of a steam engine puffing across the sky was absolutely ridiculous to most people. But it was a very efficient engine. They were not the sort of heavy steam engines you would imagine.
How did his knowledge of lace making actually adapt to making an aeroplane?
Henson was the theoretical person, and he was interested in the theory of aviation, which had just been developed by Sir George Cayley. Stringfellow's skills for bobbins were with sheet metal, thin sheet metal. And so this is the way he was able to make these very efficient engines.
Who's this Cayley chap? It sounds like he did some of the groundwork as well.
Yes, he's regarded as the father of aviation. Sir George Cayley was in the Midlands and very wealthy. He experimented with gliders and helicopters based on bird flight and on the sort of spinning flight you get with sycamore seeds. Sir George Cayley was born in 1774, and it was in the early 1800s that he did his theoretical work. There were other people working with flying, but it was William Henson, who was born in 1812, and so it was in about 1840 that he started to do all his experimenting with the help of the skills of John Stringfellow.
And what actually happened in Chard as an achievement? What was achieved here?
Well, Henson designed an aeroplane and then had it built. He was the man with the money. He scoured the country for a steam engine that would fit it. Of course, most of them were great, heavy, huge things designed to drive mill machinery, so there was nothing. In the end, Stringfellow had to design an engine for it. They went up onto the nearby hills and tried to make this thing fly, but it wouldn't because there was condensation on the wings, the silk fabric got wet, and Henson had by that time had used all his money. He gave up and he went off to America, leaving Stringfellow to carry on. Well, what John Stringfellow did was to make a cut-down version of the aeroplane, got rid of the landing gear, he launched it from a wire, changed the shape of the wings and everything to make it lighter and more efficient. Then he, with his son, they went into a disused part of the lace factory, and there they started the engine and launched the aeroplane down a sloping wire where it hit a trip which released it, and it then carried on flying to a net at the end of the building.
But that does sound like cheating, really, doing it indoors.
When you come to think of it, you've got something that's moving very slowly. Any sort of crosswind or anything like that would upset those early gliders.
Did he ever try to actually fly it outside? Once he'd successfully flown it inside, it would think the obvious thing to do is then to take it out onto one of the hills and launch it off there.
Yes, he went to the Cremorne Gardens, which were in Bath. Presumably they selected a quiet day and they did fly it there. Unfortunately, Stringfellow, his father-in-law died and he had a business in America, so he had to stop work on the aeroplane and go out to America and sort it out. And it wasn't until about 1868 when he was invited to make an aeroplane to fly at the Crystal Palace Exhibition. And this was a triplane, which was following the trends of theory at the time, and he made a much larger engine to fly in it, much more powerful. He won a prize for the engine, but not for the aircraft. And this prize he spent on making a new workshop for making his aeroplanes.
We all think of America as the place where this was developed, but it looks like the Wright brothers and the manned flight really couldn't have happened without some of this earlier work.
That's absolutely right, yes. All these things depended on the work that was done before. Stringfellow made his first flight in 1848. But from then on, the development of aircraft continued with various people working on it. When the Wright brothers were making the first aeroplane, they did exactly the same thing. They started off with a glider, and because there was no engine that would go in it, they had to make a petrol engine. The petrol spirit was becoming available, and they were able to make a petrol engine that was light and vibration-free themselves, and they put that in the glider. That's how they did it.
That was Dialect's Tony Gosling there, talking to Roger Carter, the curator of Chard Museum in South Somerset. Like Kingswood Heritage Museum in Warmley, Chard Museum on the High Street is run entirely by volunteers, but it's nevertheless facing a funding crisis as part of the LibCon coalition cuts, so if you want to visit it, do so soon. Next week, we take a trip to Kemble Airfield near Tetbury in Gloucestershire, the home of the classic Bristol Aero collection. Time now for Chapter 12 of Treasure Island, written by Robert Louis Stevenson and read by Malcolm Grieve. Treasure Island is an adventure story, and currently there's production being held down the King Street, which is an open-air production. Apparently people come out of windows for the stage entrance. It looks very exciting. So in that vein, this week, Jim Hawkins tells us what happens on board ship, the Hispaniola, after his concealment in the apple barrel.
Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 2. The Ship's Cook. Chapter 12. Council of War. There was a great rush of feet across the deck. I could hear people tumbling up from the cabin and the forecastle, and slipping in an instant outside my barrel, I dived behind the foresail, made a double towards the stern, and came out upon the open deck in time to join Hunter and Dr. Livesey in the rush for the weather bow. There, all hands were already congregated. A belt of fog had lifted almost simultaneously with the appearance of the moon. Away to the southwest of us, we saw two low hills, about a couple of miles apart, and rising behind one of them a third and higher hill, whose peak was still buried in the fog. All three seemed sharp and conical in figure. So much I saw, almost in a dream, for I had not yet recovered from my horrid fear of a minute or two before. And then I heard the voice of Captain Smollett issuing orders. The Hispaniola was laid a couple of points nearer the wind, and now sailed a course that would just clear the island on the east. "And now, men," said the captain when all was sheeted home, "has any of you ever seen that land ahead?"
"I have, sir," said Silver.
"I've watered there with a trader I was cooking."
"The anchorage is on the south, behind an islet, I fancy," asked the captain.
"Yes, sir. Skeleton Island, they calls it. It were a main place for pirates once, and a hand we had on board knowed all their names for it. That hill to the nor'ard they calls the Foremast Hill. There are three hills in a row running southward, fore, main, and mizzen, sir. But the main, that's the big one with the cloud on it, they usually calls the Spyglass. By reason of a lookout they kept there, when they was in the anchorage cleaning, for it's there they clean their ships, sir. Asking your pardon."
"I have a chart here," says Captain Smollett. "See if that's the place."
Long John's eyes burned in his head as he took the chart, but by the fresh look of the paper, I knew he was doomed to disappointment. This was not the map we'd found in Billy Bones's chest, but an accurate copy, completing all things, names and heights and soundings, with the single exception of the red crosses and the written notes. Sharp as must have been his annoyance, Silver had the strength of mind to hide it.
"Yes, sir," said he. "This is the spot, to be sure. And very prettily drawed out.
And who might have done that? The pirates were too ignorant, I reckon. Aye, here it is. Captain Kidd's Anchorage. Just the name my shipmate called it. There's a strong current runs along the south, and then away nor'ard up the west coast. Right you was, sir, says he, to haul your wind and keep the weather of the island. Leastways, if such was your intention as to enter and careen, and there ain't no better place for that in these waters. Thank you, my man, says Captain Smollett. I'll ask you later on to give us a help. You may go. I was surprised at the coolness with which Don avowed his knowledge of the island, and I own I was half frightened when I saw him drawing nearer to myself. He did not know, to be sure, that I had overheard his counsel from the apple barrel, and yet I had by this time taken such a horror of his cruelty, duplicity, and power that I could scarce conceal a shudder when he laid his hand upon my arm. Ah, says he, this here is a sweet spot, this island. A sweet spot for a lad to get ashore on. You'll bathe, and you'll climb trees, and you'll hunt goats, you will. And you'll get aloft in them hills like a goat yourself. Why, it makes me young again. I was going to forget my timber leg, I was. It's a pleasant thing to be young and have 10 toes, and you may lay to that. When you want to go a bit of exploring, you just ask old John, and he'll put up a snack for you to take along. And clapping me in the friendliest way upon the shoulder, he hobbled off forward and went below. Captain Smollett, the squire, and Dr. Livesey were talking together on the quarter-deck, and anxious as I was to tell them my story, I durst not interrupt them openly. While I was still casting about in my thoughts to find some probable excuse, Dr. Livesey called me to his side. He had left his pipe below, and being a slave to tobacco, he had meant that I should fetch it. But as soon as I was near enough to speak, and not to be overheard, I broke out immediately. "Doctor, let me speak. Get the captain and squire down to the cabin, and then make some pretence to send for me. I have terrible news." The doctor changed countenance a little, but next moment he was master of himself.
"Thank you, Jim,"
he said quite loudly.
"That was all I wanted to know."
As if he had asked me a question, and with that he turned on his heel and rejoined the other two. They spoke together for a little, and although none of them started or raised his voice or so much as whistled, it was plain enough that Dr. Livesey had communicated my request, for the next thing that I heard was the captain giving an order to Job Anderson, and all hands were piped on deck.
"My lads," said Captain Smollett, "I have a word to say to you. This land that we have sighted is the place we have been sailing to. Mr. Trelawney, being a very open-handed gentleman, as we all know, has just asked me a word or two, and as I was able to tell him that every man on board has done his duty, alow and aloft, as I never asked to see it done better, why, he and I and the doctor are going below to the cabin to drink your health and luck, and you'll have grog served out for you to drink our health and luck. I'll tell you what I think of this. I think it handsome, and if you think as I do, you'll give a good sea cheer for the gentleman that does it."
The cheer followed. That was a matter of course, but it rang out so full and hearty that I confess I could hardly believe these same men were plotting for our blood.
"One more cheer for Captain Smollett,"
cried Long John, when the first had subsided, and this also was given with a will. On the top of that, the three gentlemen went below, and not long after word was sent forward that Jim Hawkins was wanted in the cabin. I found them all three seated round the table, a bottle of Spanish wine and some raisins before them, and the doctor smoking away with his wig on his lap, and that I knew was a sign that he was agitated. The stern window was open, for it was a warm night, and you could see the moon shining behind on the ship's wake.
"Now, Hawkins," says the squire, "you have something to say. Speak up."
I did as I was bid, and as short as I could make it, told the whole details of Silver's conversation. Nobody interrupted me till I was done, nor did any one of the three of them make so much as a movement, but they kept their eyes upon my face from first to last.
"Jim," said Dr. Livesey, "take a seat."
and they made me sit down at the table beside them, poured me out a glass of wine, filled my hands with raisins, and all three, one after the other, and each with a bow, drank my good health and their service to me for my luck and courage.
"Now, Captain," said the squire, "you were right, and I was wrong. I own myself an ass, and I await your orders."
"No more an ass than I, sir," returned the captain. "I never heard of a crew that meant to mutiny, but what showed signs before, for any man that had an eye in his head to see the mischief and take steps according. But this crew," he added, "beats me." "Captain," said the doctor, "with your permission, that's Silver, a very remarkable man."
"He'll look remarkably well from a yardarm, sir," returned the captain. "But this is talk. This don't lead to anything. I see three or four points, and with Mr. Trelawney's permission, I'll name them." "You, sir, are the captain. It is for you to speak," says Mr. Trelawney grandly.
"First point," began Mr. Smollett, "we must go on, because we can't turn back. If I gave the word to go about, they would rise at once. Second point, we have time before us, at least until this treasure's found. Third point, there are faithful hands. Now, sir, it's got to come to blows sooner or later. And what I propose is to take time by the forelock, as the saying is, and come to blows some fine day when they least expect it. We can count, I take it, on your own home servants, Mr. Trelawney."
"As upon myself," declared the squire.
"Three," reckoned the captain. "Ourselves makes seven, counting Hawkins here. Now, about the honest hands."
"Most likely Trelawney's own men," said the doctor.
"Those he picked up for himself before he lit on Silver."
"Nay," replied the squire, "Hans was one of mine."
"I did think I could have trusted Hans," added the captain.
"And to think they're all Englishmen," broke out the squire. "Sir, I could find it in my heart to blow up the ship."
"Well, gentlemen," said the captain, "the best that I can say is not much. We must lay to, if you please, and keep a bright lookout. It's trying on a man, I know. It would be pleasanter to come to blows. But there's no help for it till we know our men. Lay to, and whistle for a wind. That's my view."
"Jim here," says the doctor, "can help us more than anyone. The men are not shy with him, and Jim is a noticing lad." "Hawkins, I put prodigious faith in you," added the squire.
I began to feel pretty desperate at this, for I felt altogether helpless. And yet, by an odd train of circumstances, it was indeed through me that safety came. In the meantime, talk as we pleased, there were only 7 out of the 26 on whom we knew we could rely. And out of these 7, one was a boy. So that the grown men on our side were 6 to their 19.
That was chapter 12 there of Treasure Island, written by Robert Louis Stevenson and read by Malcolm Grieve. With me in the studio now we have Rosemary Dunn. Hi, Rosemary.
Hi there.
What do you have for us today?
Okay, well, it's a poem about a nice cup of tea.
Lovely.
Which we've all just got in our hands. So thank you very much to Anthea for my nice cup of tea. And it's called The Cup That Cheers. When I switch the kettle on and I reach up for my teacup, whether China or Ceylon, it perks my brain and my physique up. It's a boon, it kills bacteria, nasty fungus and listeria. It's as English as thatched cottages, rose gardens and wisteria, staves off cancer and hysteria, is the cup that always cheers ya. Cleans the palate, warms the gullet, it makes your breath smell fresher, picks you up when you are down, it even lowers high blood pressure. Chink and clink of cup and saucer, of teaspoon, oh happy sound. Crack out sandwiches and fruitcake when the vicar calls around. There's the hiss and the whistle, the pour and the steam, as comforting as nanny or tonsillitis with ice cream. It soothes and it calms, it has its rituals and its tannin. It's like a cuddle in warm arms, has done wonders for Dot Branning. From EastEnders, because she's in her 80s. It's not coffee, it's not brash. Tea time needs cake, not a panini. Don't need Charlie Speed nor hash, or Daniel Craig in a mankini. God's in his heaven, all's all right. With a cup of tea, all is hail and hearty. So if you'd like to issue an invite, make sure it's for a big, big cup of tea party. Thank you.
Thank you very much. An ode to tea there. We're now joined in the studio by Tim Burrows. Hi, Tim.
Hi.
And I believe you have a song for us today.
Yes, it's called Every Voice Needs a Chorus. It's a bit of an eco song. It's trying to get people to kind of look after the planet and look after each other. It's about that.
Thanks very much, Tim. That was brilliant.
Oh, thank you for having me. Cheers.
A new slot now from our engineer, Mike Noyce. It's an interview with Bristol band Tom Holder and the Railway Sleepers.
Hello, I'm here today with Tom Holder, Bill Stevens and Mike Green from Tom Holder and the Railway Sleepers.
Hello.
All right.
Hello.
All right, well, first of all, let's start with your band's name. Is this just a big ego trip, Tom?
No, not really. It could be perceived as that, but I like the old-fashioned style, whereas like Buddy Holly and the Crickets, and I was a solo artist before as well, so it was just kind of like, get these guys in who was originally session players, but they enjoyed the music so much that we just started working together and came band, got them in full time.
So how many have you got in the band altogether?
Five.
How would you describe your music? What sort of influences have you got?
You got the personal influences through playing, because obviously me coming from a metal and blues and funk background, our drummer's a punk drummer.
Our accordion player is a punk accordion player. I'm originally acoustic player. Yeah, so there's a big different mash of music in there. Each song is a different genre. We've all got different influences and we all put a different thing on the table, and it's more of a brand more than an actual style, because we're not Gypsy Jazz, we're Droopy Gypsy.
We've taken Gypsy and we've chilled it out, laid it back, yeah, and then just put these different influences on top of it.
If I had to call it something, I'd say it was Gypsy Reggae Blues.
The lyrics are more drawn towards like blues style.
You mentioned you have an accordion player, so what other instruments do you have?
It is us five, but we all mix and match with different instruments. Like me and Mike will play banjo, or I'll play mandolin.
Bill gets ukulele, we're going to chuck in there.
Bill gets on the guitar now and then. We play pretty much whatever we want, whatever we think could bring something to the song.
Even a kazoo?
Even a kazoo.
The kazoos will be coming.
I think kazoos are funny, but they're also a good instrument.
You can't not smile when there's a kazoo in the mix.
So what exactly is it you write songs about?
I've wrote most of the songs myself, because I'd wrote them before I'd actually met the guys, and I usually just write about how life is in Bristol. I write quite sinister lyrics, and I like to write sinister lyrics because I'm quite a sinister person, really. I laugh at things that I shouldn't, and that's what I try and incorporate into my music. But yeah, you just have to listen. Usually people don't actually notice what I'm singing about until they listen to it back and on like a studio recording. They're like, oh, right. I still don't get it, but that's the beauty of it. I kind of got a feel of what I think is about, rather than me having to sit there and tell them.
So you're talking about studio recording. Have you got some coming up?
Yeah, I've been in the studio since just before Christmas, working on this project. The album, hopefully, fingers crossed, will be released sometime in September.
So is this getting quite expensive in the studio? You've obviously got to practice a lot first.
It's crazy being in the studio, really.
It is. The thing is, I've been working with Flash now. We're recording out in Bath, Riverside Youth Centre, so it's free. But it is strange atmosphere. I've worked with him for so long now, though, that I'm actually used to it. But when I bring in guys, they're not used to how life is in the studio. I find that it's a nice atmosphere in there, and we always get considerable amount of work done, you know?
It's definitely been a different experience from me being in the recording studio, especially doing Swinging in the Wind, which I do believe you're going to be hearing later. Recording that was very different. I was actually sat in the control room rather than in a playing room, and I was plugged straight into the desk. And so actually being sat in the same room as the engineer, and with Tom there over my shoulder as well, it was just a bit like, oh god. And also it was like a week after I joined the band.
It wasn't very long at all. Like I said initially, they were session musicians, so I thought, get them in, they can go on my track, they can get a write up, and then we can go and do our gigs and stuff like that. But we all do enjoy the music so much that it's just become a project for us now, and it's more of a band than actually me organising everything.
So like the track that we'll be hearing is actually like a milestone, I guess. It's like, this is the point we are at with this at the moment.
Yeah.
So what you hear now, if you like it, then you're going to be very interested in the final product of it.
Definitely.
It's only going to get better.
Like, you can hear the different influences just on the recording. There's the backing vocals, which are kind of like Benefit of Mr. Kite by the Beatles. They're kind of sinister, sort of carnival craziness going on there, but I love that.
Okay, so let's just hear the track now, shall we?
Swinging in the Wind, studio demo.
Let's hope you enjoy it.
It's awfully chilly, but I'm still swinging. Swinging in the wind. My head is is killing, constant grinning, stuck out in the wind. If truth be told, I'm not too bold, the air is free to flow. My eyes don't feel as if they are real, living in my skull. When you're out and about, I like a good chat, but I'm always out. It's not so thrilling, but I'm still swinging, swinging in the wind. My head is killing, constant grinning, stuck out in the wind. My hair's too long, my head's going wrong, and the meds are running low. There must be a cure, but you're never too sure. Spare a pound for the clown. Give me a shout when you're out and about. I like a good chat, but I'm not always out.
That was Swinging in the Wind by Tom Holder and the Railway Sleepers. So if anyone wants to contact you, how can they get in touch?
Oh, you can contact me by my email address, which is tom_holdermusic@hotmail.co.uk. You can also check us out on MySpace, www.myspace.com/TomTomHolder, or even check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/Tom.HolderMusic.
Have you got any gigs coming up?
Yeah, we do. We're getting quite busy at the moment, actually. We've got 2 gigs lined up in Bath at the moment.
They'll be at the St. James's Wine Vault.
29th of July
and the 9th of September.
Yep, and that's both on Friday night, so it's going to look a lot different down there. We're going to do some decorating, and we're going to put on a good show for you guys. We got a couple of acoustic sets lined up. It's just for the listeners, just so they can get a taste of what we're really about, and then they can come along to an actual full band gig. And
it's a bit of a chilled out version of the proper set.
Definitely.
Because, you know, the proper set, there's like 5 of us on stage. And, you know,
it's crazy sometimes.
It can do, yeah. So these acoustic sets are a chance to just like play the music in a more chilled out way. Yeah, it's just like if you like this and you like going to gigs, then you're gonna end up loving the live sets.
Yeah, definitely.
So Tom Holder and the Railway Sleepers, thank you very much.
Sure, thank you. Peace.
And just again, contact details, that's tom_holdermusic@hotmail.co.uk, www.myspace.com/tomtomholder, www.facebook.com/tom.holdermusic.
And you can always hunt us down in the street.
Yeah, you'll find us, don't worry about it. We'll be there.
Buy us cider.
That was Mike Noyce there interviewing Bristol band Tom Holder and the Railway Sleepers. Next up, we've got Jeff Sparks with the What's On Guide. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, this is a What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Wednesday, 20th of July, Lars Fredriksson and the Old Firm Casuals will be performing with support from RG Bargy and Control at the Croft in Stokes Croft, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £11 in advance. Into Thursday, 21st of July, John Amore Blues Band will be performing with support from Joe Harmon Band at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £5 in advance. On to Saturday, 23rd of July, the Casualties will be performing with support from Moral Dilemma, Officer Down and also the Dirty Rotten Scoundrels at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. Finally, on Sunday, 24th of July, it's Philo's Crash Mania National Banger Racing at Mendip's Raceway, which is at Warrens Hill Road near Shipham in Somerset. Event starts at 1:30 p.m. and tickets are £11 for adults, £6 for OAPs, £3 for children, and a family ticket costs £25. For more information, you can check out www.mendipsraceway.com. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you. That's all from Dialect this week. Features were by Tony Gosling, Alec Milne, Anthea Page and Mike Noyce. We had Malcolm Reeve reading Chapter 12 of Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. We had Rosemary Dunn reading his poem and Tim Burrows performed a song for us. Finally, last but not least, we had The What's On Guide by Jeff Sparks. So that is all for this week. The engineer was Michael Noyce, the producer was Anthea Page. I'm Michaela Dennis.
And I'm John Peters Coleman.
Where have you been?
Asleep under the desk.
Wonderful. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you.
The sun will fall.